Hachette Audio presents Make Your Bed, Little Things That Can Change Your Life and Maybe the World. Written and read by Admiral William H. McRaven, United States Navy, retired. To my three children, Bill, John, and Kelly. No father could be prouder of his kids than I am of you. Every moment in my life has been made better because you are in the world. And to my wife, George Ann, my best friend, who made all of my dreams possible, where would I be without you? Forward. In May 2014, I was honored to give the commencement speech for the graduating class of the University of Texas at Austin. Even though the university was my alma mater, I was concerned that a military officer, whose career had been defined by war, might not find a welcoming audience among college students. But to my great surprise, the graduating class embraced the speech. The 10 lessons I learned from Navy SEAL training, which were the basis for my remarks, seemed to have a universal appeal. They were simple lessons that dealt with overcoming the trials of SEAL training, but the 10 lessons were equally important in dealing with the challenges of life, no matter who you are. Over the past 3 years, I have been stopped on the street by great folks telling me their own stories, how they didn't back down from the sharks, how they didn't ring the bell, or how making their bed every morning helped them through tough times. They all wanted to know more about how the 10 lessons shaped my life and about the people who inspired me during my career. This small book is an attempt to do so. Each chapter gives a little more context to the individual lessons and also adds a short story about some of the people who inspired me with their discipline, their perseverance, their honor, and their courage. I hope you enjoy the book. Chapter 1. Start your day with a task completed. If you want to change the world, start off by making your bed. The barracks at Basic SEAL Training is a nondescript three-story building located on the beach at Coronado, California, just 100 yards from the Pacific Ocean. There is no air conditioning in the building, and at night, with the windows open, you can hear the tide roll in and the surf pounding against the sand. Rooms in the barracks are Spartan. In the officer's room, where I berthed with three other classmates, there were four beds, a closet to hang your uniforms, and nothing else. Those mornings that I stayed in the barracks, I would roll out of my Navy rack and immediately begin the process of making my bed. It was the first task of the day, a day that I knew would be filled with uniform inspections, long swims, longer runs, obstacle courses, and constant harassment from SEAL instructors. "Attention," shouted the class leader, Lieutenant Junior Grade Daniel Stewart, as the instructor entered the room. Standing at the foot of the bed, I snapped my heels together and stood up straight as a chief petty officer approached my position. The instructor, stern and expressionless, began the inspection by checking the starch in my green uniform hat to ensure the eight-sided cover was crisp and correctly blocked. Moving from top to bottom, his eyes looked over every inch of my uniform. Were the creases in the blouse and the trousers aligned? Was the brass on the belt shined to a mirror-like radiance? Were my boots polished bright enough so he could see his fingers in their reflection? Satisfied that I met the high standards expected of a SEAL trainee, he moved to inspect the bed. The bed was as simple as the room, nothing but a steel frame and a single mattress. A bottom sheet covered the mattress, and over that was a top sheet. A gray wool blanket tucked tightly under the mattress provided warmth from the cool San Diego evenings. A second blanket was expertly folded into a rectangle at the foot of the bed. A single pillow, made by the Lighthouse of the Blind, was centered at the top of the bed and intersected at a 90-degree angle with the blanket at the bottom. This was the standard. Any deviation from this exacting requirement would be cause for me to hit the surf and then roll around on the beach until I was covered head to toe with wet sand, referred to as a sugar cookie. Standing motionless, I could see the instructor out of the corner of my eye. He warily looked at my bed. Bending over, he checked the hospital corners and then surveyed the blanket and the pillow to ensure they were correctly aligned. Then, reaching into his pocket, he pulled out a quarter and flipped it into the air several times to ensure I knew the final test of the bed was coming. With one final flip, the quarter flew high into the air and came down on the mattress with a light bounce. It jumped several inches off the bed high enough for the instructor to catch it in his hand. Swinging around to face me, the instructor looked me in the eye and nodded. He never said a word. Making my bed correctly was not going to be an opportunity for praise. It was expected of me. It was my first task of the day. and doing it right was important. It demonstrated my discipline. It showed my attention to detail, and at the end of the day, it would be a reminder that I had done something well, something to be proud of, no matter how small the task. Throughout my life in the Navy, making my bed was the one constant that I could count on every day. As a young SEAL ensign aboard the USS Grayback, a special operations submarine, I was berthed in sick bay where the beds were stacked four high. The salty old doctor who ran sick bay insisted that I make my rack every morning. He often remarked that if the beds were not made and the room was not clean, how could the sailors expect the best medical care? As I later found out, this sentiment of cleanliness and order applied to every aspect of military life. 30 years later, the Twin Towers came down in New York City. The Pentagon was struck, and brave Americans died in an airplane over Pennsylvania. At the time of the attacks, I was recuperating in my home from a serious parachute accident. A hospital bed had been wheeled into my government quarters, and I spent most of the day lying on my back trying to recover. I wanted out of that bed more than anything else. Like every SEAL, I longed to be with my fellow warriors in the fight. When I was finally well enough to lift myself unaided from the bed, the first thing I did was pull the sheets up tight, adjust the pillow, and make sure the hospital bed looked presentable to all those who entered my home. It was my way of showing that I had conquered the injury and was moving forward with my life. Within 4 weeks of 9/11, I was transferred to the White House, where I spent the next 2 years in the newly formed Office of Combating Terrorism. By October 2003, I was in Iraq at our makeshift headquarters on the Baghdad airfield. For the first few months, we slept on Army cots. Nevertheless, I would wake every morning, roll up my sleeping bag, place the pillow at the head of the cot, and get ready for the day. In December 2003, U.S. forces captured Saddam Hussein. He was held in confinement, during which time we kept him in a small room. He also slept on an Army cot, but with the luxury of sheets and a blanket. Once a day, I would visit Saddam to ensure my soldiers were properly caring for him. I noticed with some sense of amusement that Saddam did not make his bed. The covers were always crumpled at the foot of his cot, and he rarely seemed inclined to straighten them. During the ensuing 10 years, I had the honor of working with some of the finest men and women the nation has ever produced. From generals to privates, from admirals to seamen recruits, from ambassadors to clerk typists. The Americans who deployed overseas in support of the war effort came willingly, sacrificing much to protect this great nation. They all understood that life is hard, and that sometimes there is little you can do to affect the outcome of your day. In battle, soldiers die, families grieve, your days are long and filled with anxious moments. You search for something that can give you solace, that can motivate you to begin your day, that can be a sense of pride in an oft-times ugly world. But it is not just combat. It is daily life that needs the same sense of structure. Nothing can replace the strength and comfort of one's faith. But sometimes, the simple act of making your bed can give you the lift you need to start your day and provide you the satisfaction to end it right. If you want to change your life, and maybe the world, start off by making your bed. Chapter 2. You Can't Go It Alone. If you want to change the world, find someone to help you paddle. I learned early on in SEAL training the value of teamwork, the need to rely on someone else to help you through the difficult tasks. For those of us who were tadpoles, hoping to become Navy frogmen, a 10-foot rubber raft was used to teach us this vital lesson. Everywhere we went during the first phase of SEAL training, we were required to carry the raft. We placed it on our heads as we ran from the barracks, across the highway to the chow hall. We carried it in a low-slung position as we ran up and down the Coronado sand dunes. We paddled the boat endlessly from north to south along the coastline and through the pounding surf. 7 men, all working together to get the rubber boat to its final destination. But we learned something else on our journey with the raft. Occasionally, one of the boat crew members was sick or injured, unable to give it 100%. I often found myself exhausted from the training day or down with a cold or flu. On those days, the other members picked up the slack. They paddled harder. They dug deeper. They gave me their rations for extra strength. And when the time came, later in training, I returned the favor. The small rubber boat made us realize that no man could make it through training alone. No SEAL could make it through combat alone, and by extension, You needed people in your life to help you through the difficult times. Never was the need for help more apparent to me than 25 years later when I commanded all the SEALs on the West Coast. I was the Commodore of Naval Special Warfare Group 1 in Coronado. A Navy captain, I had by now spent the past several decades leading SEALs around the world. I was out for a routine parachute jump when things went terribly wrong. We were in a C-130 Hercules aircraft climbing to 12,000 feet preparing for the jump. Looking out of the back of the aircraft, we could see a beautiful California day, not a cloud in the sky. The Pacific Ocean was calm, and from this altitude, you could see the border of Mexico just a few miles away. The jump master yelled to stand by. Now on the edge of the ramp, I could see straight down to the ground. The jump master looked me in the eye, smiled, and shouted, "Go! Go! Go!" I dove out the aircraft, arms fully extended and legs tucked slightly behind my back. The prop blast from the aircraft sent me tilting forward until my arms caught the air and I leveled out. I quickly checked my altimeter, made sure I wasn't spinning, and then looked around me to ensure no jumper was too close to me. 20 seconds later, I had fallen to the pull altitude of 5,500 feet. Suddenly, I looked below me, and another jumper had slid beneath me, intersecting my path to the ground. He pulled his ripcord, and I could see the pilot chute deploying the main parachute from his backpack. Immediately, I thrust my arms to my side, forcing my head to the ground in an attempt to get away from the blossoming chute. It was too late. The jumper chute popped open in front of me, like an airbag, hitting me at 120 miles an hour. I bounced off the main canopy and spun out of control, barely conscious from the impact. For seconds, I spun head over heels, trying to get stable again. I couldn't see my altimeter and was unaware of how far I had fallen. Instinctively, I reached for my ripcord and pulled. The pilot chute jettisoned from its small pouch in the back of the parachute, but wrapped around my leg as I continued to tumble toward the ground. As I struggled to untangle myself, the situation got worse. The main parachute partially deployed, but in doing so, twirled around my other leg. Craning my neck toward the sky, I could see my legs were bound by two sets of risers, the long nylon straps that connect the main parachute to the harness on my back. One riser had wrapped around one leg, the other riser around the other leg. The main parachute was fully out of the backpack, but hung up somewhere on my body. As I struggled to break free of the entanglement, suddenly I felt the canopy lift off my body and begin to open. Looking toward my legs, I knew what was coming next. Within seconds, the canopy caught air. The two risers, one wrapped around each leg, suddenly and violently pulled apart, taking my legs with them. My pelvis separated instantly as the force of the opening ripped my lower torso. The thousand small muscles that connect the pelvis to the body were torn from their hinges. My mouth dropped open, and I let out a scream that could be heard in Mexico. Searing pain arched through my body, sending waves pulsating downward to my pelvis and upward to my head. Violent, muscular convulsions racked my upper torso, shooting more pain through my arms and legs. Now, like having an out-of-body experience, I became aware of my screaming and tried to control it, but the pain was too intense. Still head down and falling too fast, I turned myself upright in the harness, relieving some of the pressure on my pelvis and back. 1,500 feet. I had fallen over 4,000 feet before the parachute deployed. The good news, I had a full canopy over my head. The bad news, I was broken apart by the impact of the opening. I landed over 2 miles from the drop zone. Within a few minutes, the drop zone crew and an ambulance arrived. I was taken to the trauma hospital in downtown San Diego. By the next day, I was out of surgery. The accident had ripped my pelvis apart by almost 5 inches. The muscles in my stomach had become detached from the pelvic bone, and the muscles in my back and legs were severely damaged from the opening shock. I had a large titanium plate screwed into my pelvis and a long scapular screw drilled into my backside for stability. This seemed like the end of my career. To be an effective SEAL, you had to be physically fit. My rehabilitation was going to take months, maybe years, and the Navy was required to conduct a medical evaluation to determine if I was fit for duty. I left the hospital 7 days later, but remained bedridden at my home for the next 2 months. All my life, I had the feeling I was invincible. I believed that my innate athletic abilities could get me out of the most perilous situations. And, up to this point, I had been right. Many times during my career, I had encountered life-threatening incidents. Mid-air collisions in another parachute, uncontrolled descents in a mini-sub, nearly falling hundreds of feet off an oil rig, trapped beneath a sinking boat, demolition that exploded prematurely, and countless more incidents where a split second decided the fate between living and dying. Each time, I had somehow managed to make the right decision, and each time, I was physically fit enough to overcome the challenges before me. Not this time. Now lying in bed, all I felt was self-pity, but that would not last for long. My wife, Georgianne, had been given nursing duties. She cleaned my wounds, gave me the required daily shots, and changed my bedpan. But most importantly, she reminded me of who I was. I had never given up on anything in my life, and she assured me that I was not going to start now. She refused to let me feel sorry for myself. It was the kind of tough love that I needed, and as the days went by, I got better. My friends came by the house, called constantly, and helped with whatever they could. My boss, Admiral Eric Olson, somehow found a way around the policy that required the Navy to conduct a medical evaluation of my ability to continue to serve as a SEAL. His support for me likely saved my career. During my time in the SEAL teams, I had numerous setbacks, and in each case, someone came forward to help me. Someone who had faith in my abilities. Someone who saw potential in me where others might not. Someone who risked their own reputation to advance my career. I have never forgotten those people, and I know that anything I achieved in my life was a result of others who helped me along the way. None of us are immune from life's tragic moments. Like the small rubber boat we had in basic SEAL training, it takes a team of good people to get you to your destination in life. You cannot paddle the boat alone. Find someone to share your life with. Make as many friends as possible. And never forget that your success depends on others. Chapter 3. Only the size of your heart matters. If you want to change the world, measure a person by the size of their heart. I ran to the beach with my black rubber flippers tucked underneath my arm and my mask in my left hand. Coming to parade rest, I anchored the flippers in the soft sand, leaning them against each other to form a teepee. Standing to my right and left were other students. Dressed in green t-shirts, khaki swim trunks, neoprene booties, and a small life jacket, we were preparing for our morning 2-mile swim. The life jacket was a small, rubberized bladder that inflated only when you pulled the handle. Among the students, it was considered shameful if you had to use your life jacket. Still, the SEAL instructors were required to inspect every life jacket before each swim. This inspection also gave the instructors an opportunity for more harassment. The surf off Coronado that day was about 8 feet high. The waves were coming in lines of three, plunging with a roaring sound that made each student's heart beat a little faster. As the instructor moved slowly down the line, he came to the man directly to my right. The student, a seaman recruit and brand new to the Navy, was about 5'4" in height. The SEAL instructor, a highly decorated Vietnam vet, was well above 6'2" and towered over the smaller man. After inspecting the student's life jacket, the instructor looked over his left shoulder toward the pounding surf and then reached down and grabbed the student's flippers. Holding them close to the young sailor's face, he said quietly, "Do you really want to be a frogman?" The sailor stood up straight, and with a look of defiance in his eyes, "Yes, instructor, I do," he shouted. "You're a tiny little man," the instructor said, waving the flippers in his face. "Those waves out there could break you in half." He paused and glanced towards the ocean. "You should think about quitting now before you get hurt." Even out of the corner of my eye, I could see the student's jaw begin to tighten. "I won't quit," the sailor replied, drawing out each word. Then the instructor leaned in and whispered something in the student's ear. I couldn't make out the words over the breaking waves. After all the trainees were inspected, the instructors ordered us into the water, and we began our swim. An hour later, I crawled out of the surf zone, and standing on the beach was the young seaman recruit. He had finished the swim near the head of the class. Later that day, I pulled him aside and asked what the instructor had whispered to him. He smiled and said proudly, "Prove me wrong." SEAL training was always about proving something. Proving that size didn't matter. Proving that the color of your skin wasn't important. Proving that money didn't make you better. Proving that determination and grit were always more important than talent. I was fortunate to learn that lesson a year before training began. As I boarded the city bus in downtown San Diego, I was excited about the prospect of visiting the basic SEAL training facility across the bay in Coronado. I was a first-class midshipman attending my summer cruise as part of the Naval Reserve Officers Training Corps, ROTC program. As a first-class midshipman, I was between my junior and senior years in college, and if all went well, I hoped to be commissioned the following summer and head off to SEAL training. It was the middle of the week, and I had received permission from my ROTC instructor to deviate from the planned training aboard one of the ships in port and make my way to Coronado. I got off the bus outside the famed Hotel del Coronado and walked about a mile down the road to the beach side of the Naval Amphibious Base. I passed by several Korean War vintage buildings that housed underwater demolition teams 11 and 12. Outside the one-story rambling brick building was a large wooden sign depicting Freddy the Frog, a large green web-footed amphibian carrying a stick of TNT and smoking a cigar. This was the home of the West Coast Frogmen, those intrepid mask and fin warriors whose military ancestors had cleared the beaches of Iwo Jima, Tarawa, Guam, and Incheon. My heart began to beat a little faster. This was exactly where I wanted to be in a year. As I passed the underwater demolition teams, the next building belonged to SEAL Team 1. At the time, a new breed of jungle fighters who had earned their reputation in Vietnam as some of the toughest men in the military. Another large wooden sign showed Sammy the SEAL, a dagger in one hand and dark cloak wrapped around his shoulders. As I would later learn, the frogmen and the SEALs were one and the same. All the men were graduates of SEAL training, all frogmen at heart. Finally, I approached the last government building on the beach side of the naval base. On the outer facade of the building, it read, "Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Training." Standing outside the main entrance were two SEAL instructors, surrounded by some young high school sea cadets. The two SEALs towered over the high school students. Senior Chief Petty Officer Dick Ray stood 6'3" with broad shoulders, a thin waist, a deep tan, and a dark pencil-thin mustache. He was everything I expected a SEAL to look like. Standing next to him was Chief Petty Officer Gene Wentz. Well over 6 feet, Wentz was built like a linebacker, with imposing biceps and a steely-eyed glare that cautioned everyone not to get too close. The sea cadets were ushered into the building. With some trepidation, I followed them and stopped at the front desk. I told the young sailor manning the desk my story. I was a midshipman from the University of Texas and hoped to talk with someone about SEAL training. The sailor left his desk momentarily, returning to inform me that the first phase officer, Lieutenant Doug Huth, would be glad to talk with me in a few minutes. As I waited to be called into Lieutenant Huth's office, I slowly walked up and down the hall, looking at the pictures that adorned the walls. There were photos of SEALs in Vietnam, guys rising out of the waist-deep mud along the Mekong Delta, pictures of camouflaged SEAL platoons returning from a night mission, men loaded with automatic weapons and bandoliers of ammunition boarding a swift boat heading into the jungle. Down the long hall, I saw another man looking at the photos. A civilian by his attire, he was slightly built, almost frail, and a mop of dark hair hung beetle-like over his ears. He seemed to be staring in awe at the incredible warriors whose actions were portrayed in the photos. In my mind, I wondered if he thought he had what it took to be a Navy SEAL. Looking at those pictures, did he really think he was tough enough to endure the training? Did he think his small frame could carry a heavy rucksack and 1,000 rounds of ammunition? Hadn't he seen the two SEAL instructors who were just at the front door, massive men who clearly had the right stuff? I felt a pang of sorrow that someone had misled this fellow, maybe encouraged him to leave his comfortable life as a civilian and try SEAL training. A few minutes later, the sailor from the front desk calmly walked down the corridor and escorted me to Lieutenant Huth's office. Doug Huth was also a recruiting poster for the SEALs. Tall, muscular, with brown wavy hair, he looked very sharp in his navy khaki uniform. I sat in a chair across from Huth's desk, and we talked about SEAL training and the demands of the program. Huth told me about his experience in Vietnam and what life would be like in the teams if I graduated from SEAL training. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see the thin man in civilian clothes as he continued to gaze at the photos on the wall. Like me, he must have been waiting to see Lieutenant Huth in hopes of learning more about SEAL training. It made me feel good about myself, knowing that I was clearly stronger and more prepared than another man who thought he could survive the rigors of being a SEAL. In the middle of our conversation, Lieutenant Huth suddenly stopped talking, looked up from his desk, and yelled to the man in the hall. I stood up as Huth motioned the thin man to come into the office. "Bill, this is Tommy Norris," he said, giving the thin man a big bear hug. "Tommy was the last SEAL Medal of Honor recipient from Vietnam," Huth added. Norris smiled, somewhat embarrassed by the introduction. I smiled back, shook his hand, and laughed at myself. This seemingly frail, mop-haired man, who I doubted could make it through training, was Lieutenant Tom Norris. Tom Norris, who had served in Vietnam, had on successive nights gone deep behind enemy lines to rescue two downed airmen. This was Tom Norris, who, on another mission, was shot in the face by North Vietnamese forces and left for dead, only to be rescued by Petty Officer Mike Thornton, who would later receive the Medal of Honor for those actions. This was Tom Norris, who battled back from his injury to be accepted into the FBI's first hostage rescue team. This quiet, reserved, humble man was one of the toughest SEALs in the long history of the teams. In 1969, Tommy Norris was almost booted out of SEAL training. They said he was too small, too thin, and not strong enough. But much like the young sailor in my class, Norris proved them all wrong, and once again showed it's not the size of your flippers that count, just the size of your heart. Chapter 4. Life's Not Fair, Drive On. If you want to change the world, get over being a sugar cookie and keep moving forward. I ran to the top of the sand dune and without hesitation sprinted down the other side, heading full speed toward the Pacific Ocean. Fully clothed in my green utilities, short-billed hat, and combat boots, I dove headfirst into the waves as they pounded the beach off Coronado, California. Emerging soaking wet from the water, I saw the SEAL instructor standing on the dune. With his arms folded and a piercing glare that cut through the morning haze, I heard him yell, "You know what to do, Mr. Mack." Indeed, I did. With feigned enthusiasm, I screamed a hearty "Hoo-yah!" at the top of my lungs and fell face down into the soft sand, rolling from side to side to ensure that no part of my uniform was left uncovered. Then, for good measure, I sat up, reached deep into the ground, and tossed sand into the air to guarantee it found its way into every crevice in my body. Somewhere during the morning physical training, I had committed a violation of the SEAL training rules. My punishment was to jump into the surf zone, roll around in the sand, and make myself a sugar cookie. In all of SEAL training, there was nothing more uncomfortable than being a sugar cookie. There were a lot of things more painful and more exhausting, but being a sugar cookie tested your patience and your determination, not just because you spent the rest of the day with sand down your neck, under your arms, and between your legs, but because the act of becoming a sugar cookie was completely indiscriminate. There was no rhyme or reason. You became a sugar cookie at the whim of the instructor. To many of the SEAL trainees, this was hard to accept. Those that strive to be the very best expected that they would be rewarded for their stellar performance. Sometimes they were, and then again, sometimes they were not. Sometimes the only thing they got for all their effort was wet and sandy. Feeling like I was sufficiently coated with sand, I ran to the instructor, yelled "Hoo-yah!" again, and came to attention. Looking me over, to see if I met his standard of excellence in sugar cookies was Lieutenant Philip L. Martin, known to his friends as Moki. I, however, was not on a first-name basis with Lieutenant Martin. Moki Martin was the quintessential frogman. Born and raised in Hawaii, he was everything I strive to be as a SEAL officer. An experienced Vietnam veteran, he was an expert with every weapon in the SEAL inventory. He was one of the finest skydivers in the teams, and being a native Hawaiian, he was so skilled in the water that there were few, if any, who could match him. Mr. Mack, do you have any idea why you are a sugar cookie this morning? Martin said in a very calm but questioning manner. No, Instructor Martin, I dutifully responded. Because, Mr. Mack, life isn't fair, and the sooner you learn that, the better off you will be. A year later, Lieutenant Martin and I were on a first-name basis. I had completed basic SEAL training, and he had been reassigned from the training center to Underwater Demolition Team 11 in Coronado. The more I got to know Moki, the deeper my respect grew for him. In addition to being a superb SEAL operator, Moki was also a phenomenal athlete. In the early 1980s, he was on the leading edge of the triathlon craze. He had a beautiful freestyle stroke in the open ocean. His calves and thighs were strong and moved him effortlessly on the long runs. But his real advantage was the bicycle. He and the bike were made for each other. Every morning he would mount the bike and go for a 30-mile ride up and down the Coronado Silver Strand. There was a flat stretch of paved bike path that paralleled the Pacific Ocean. It ran from the city of Coronado to the city of Imperial Beach. With the ocean on one side and the bay on the other, it was one of the most beautiful sections of beach in California. Early one Saturday morning, Moki was out on a training ride along the Silver Strand. Head down, pedaling fast, he never saw the oncoming bicycle. At roughly 25 miles an hour, the two bikes collided head-on. The bikes crumpled from the impact, slamming the riders together, leaving both men face down on the asphalt path. The first rider rolled over, dusted himself off, and struggled to his feet. He was banged up but otherwise fine. Moki remained face down, unable to move. The paramedics arrived within minutes, stabilized Moki, and transported him to the hospital. Initially, there was hope that the paralysis was temporary, but as the days, months, and years passed, Moki never regained the use of his legs. The crash left him paralyzed from the waist down, with limited movement in his arms. For the past 35 years, Moki has been in a wheelchair. In all of those years, I never once heard him complain about his misfortune in life. Never once did I hear him ask, "Why me?" Never once did he display an ounce of pity for himself. In fact, after his accident, Moki went on to be an accomplished painter. He fathered a beautiful young girl. He founded and continues to oversee the Super Frog Triathlon that is held every year in Coronado. It is easy to blame your lot in life on some outside force, to stop trying because you believe fate is against you. It's easy to think that where you were raised, how your parents treated you, or what school you went to is all that determines your future. Nothing could be further from the truth. The common people and the great men and women are all defined by how they deal with life's unfairness. Helen Keller, Nelson Mandela, Stephen Hawking, Malala Yousafzai, and Moki Martin. Sometimes, no matter how hard you try, no matter how good you are, you still end up as a sugar cookie. Don't complain. Don't blame it on your misfortune. Stand tall, look to the future, and drive on. Chapter 5. Failure Can Make You Stronger. If you want to change the world, don't be afraid of the circus. The waves off Coronado Island were choppy, the small white caps slapping us in the face as we side-stroked back towards the beach. As usual, my swim buddy and I were struggling to keep up with the rest of the SEAL training class. The instructors on the safety boat were yelling for us to pick up the pace, but it seemed like the harder we swam, the farther we fell behind. My swim buddy that day was Ensign Mark Thomas. Like me, Mark had received his commission through the Reserve Officers Training Corps, ROTC. He was a graduate of the Virginia Military Institute and one of the best long-distance runners in the class. In SEAL training, your swim buddy was the person you relied on to have your back. It was your swim buddy who you were physically tied to on the underwater dives. It was your swim buddy who you were partnered with on the long swims. Your swim buddy helped you study, kept you motivated, and became your closest ally throughout training. And as swim buddies, if one of you failed an event, both of you suffered the consequences. It was the instructor's way of reinforcing the importance of teamwork. As we finished the swim and crossed onto the beach, a SEAL instructor was waiting for us. "Drop down," the instructor yelled. This was the command, to fall into the push-up position, back straight, arms fully extended, and head up. "You two call yourselves officers?" There was no point in answering. We both knew he would continue. "Officers in the SEAL teams lead the way. They don't come in last on the swims. They don't embarrass their class." The instructor moved around us, kicking sand in our face as he circled. "I don't think you gentlemen are going to make it. I don't think you have what it takes to be SEAL officers." Pulling a small black notebook from his back pocket, he looked at us with disgust and jotted something down in the book. "You two just made the circus list." He shook his head. "You'll be lucky if you survive another week." The circus. It was the last thing either Mark or I wanted. The circus was held every afternoon at the end of training. The circus was another 2 hours of additional calisthenics combined with nonstop harassment by SEAL combat veterans who wanted only the strong to survive training. If you failed to meet the standard on any event that day, calisthenics, the obstacle course, the timed runs of the swims, your name was on the list. In the eyes of the instructors, you were a failure. What made the circus so feared by the students was not just the additional pain, but also the knowledge that the day after the circus, you would be exhausted from the extra workout and so fatigued that you would fail to meet the standards again. Another circus would follow, then another, and another. It was a death spiral, a cycle of failure that caused many students to quit training. As the rest of the students completed the day's events, Mark and I, along with several others, assembled on the asphalt grinder to begin another long session of calisthenics. Because we had come in last on the swim, the instructors had tailored the circus just for us that day. Flutter kicks. Lots and lots of flutter kicks. The flutter kicks were designed to strengthen your abdominals and thighs so you could power your way through the long open ocean swims. They were also designed to break you. The flutter kick exercise called for you to lay on your back with legs extended directly in front of you and your hands behind your head. As the instructor counted repetitions, you alternated moving your legs up and down in a kicking motion. At no time during the exercise were you allowed to bend your knees. Bending your knees was considered weakness among frogmen. The circus was punishing. Hundreds of flutter kicks, as well as push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, and 8-count bodybuilders. By the time the sun went down, Mark and I could barely move. Failure had a price. The next day brought more calisthenics, another run, another obstacle course, another swim, and unfortunately, another circus. More sit-ups, more push-ups, and a lot more flutter kicks. But as the circuses continued, a funny thing happened. Our swims got better, and Mark and I began to move up in the pack. The circus, which had started as a punishment for failure, was making us stronger, faster, and more confident in the water. While other students quit, unable to handle the occasional failure and the pain it brought, Mark and I were determined not to allow the circus to beat us. As training was coming to an end, there was one final open ocean swim, a 5-miler off the coast of San Clemente Island. Completing it in the allowable time was essential to graduating from SEAL training. The water was bitterly cold as we jumped off the pier and into the ocean. 15 swim pairs entered the water and began the long trek out of the small bay, around the peninsula, and over the kelp beds. After about 2 hours, the swim pairs were so spread out you couldn't tell where you were in the pack. 4 hours into the swim, numb, exhausted, and on the verge of hypothermia, Mark Thomas and I crossed the beach. There, waiting at the surf's edge, was the instructor. "Drop down," he yelled. My hands and feet were so cold I couldn't feel the sand beneath my fingers and toes. With my head straining to keep upright, all I could see was the instructor's boots as he walked around marking me. "Once again, you two officers have embarrassed your class." Another set of boots appeared in my view, and then another. Several instructors were now surrounding us. "You have made all your teammates look bad," he paused. "Recover, gentlemen." As Mark and I got to our feet, we looked around the beach and suddenly realized we were the first swim pair to finish. "You embarrassed them, all right," the instructor smiled. "The second pair isn't even in sight." Mark and I turned to look toward the ocean, and sure enough, there was no one in view. "Well done, gentlemen. It looks like all that extra pain and suffering paid off." The instructor paused, stepped over, and shook our hands. "I'll be honored to serve with you when you get to the teams." We had made it. The long swim was the final tough event of training. Several days later, Mark and I graduated. Mark went on to have a distinguished career in the SEAL teams, and we remain close friends to this day. In life, you will face a lot of circuses. You will pay for your failures. But if you persevere, if you let those failures teach you and strengthen you, then you will be prepared to handle life's toughest moments. July 1983 was one of those tough moments. As I stood before the commanding officer, I thought my career as a Navy SEAL was over. I had just been relieved of my SEAL squadron, fired for trying to change the way my squadron was organized, trained, and conducted missions. There were some magnificent officers and enlisted men in the organization, some of the most professional warriors I had ever been around. However, much of the culture was still rooted in the Vietnam era, and I thought it was time for a change. As I was to find out, change is never easy, particularly for the person in charge. Fortunately, even though I was fired, my commanding officer allowed me to transfer to another SEAL team, but my reputation as a SEAL officer was severely damaged. Everywhere I went, other officers and enlisted men knew I had failed, and every day there were whispers and subtle reminders that maybe I wasn't up to the task of being a SEAL. At that point in my career, I had two options: quit and move on to civilian life, which seemed like the logical choice in light of my recent officer fitness report, or weather the storm and prove to others and myself that I was a good SEAL officer. I chose the latter. Soon after being fired, I was given a second chance, an opportunity to deploy overseas as the officer in charge of a SEAL platoon. Most of the time on that overseas deployment, we were in remote locations, isolated and on our own. I took advantage of the opportunity to show that I could still lead. When you live in close quarters with 12 SEALs, there isn't anywhere to hide. They know if you are giving 100% on the morning workout. They see when you are first in line to jump out of the airplane and last in line to get the chow. They watch you clean your weapon, check your radio, read the intelligence, and prepare your mission briefs. They know when you have worked all night preparing for tomorrow's training. As month after month of overseas deployment wore on, I used my previous failure as motivation to outwork, out-hustle, and outperform everyone in the platoon. I sometimes fell short of being the best, but I never fell short of giving it my best. In time, I regained the respect of my men. Several years later, I was selected to command a SEAL team of my own. Eventually, I would go on to command all the SEALs on the West Coast. By 2003, I found myself in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now that I was a one-star admiral leading troops in a war zone, every decision I made had its consequences. Over the next several years, I stumbled often. But for every failure, for every mistake, there were hundreds of successes. Hostages rescued, suicide bombers stopped, pirates captured, terrorists killed, and countless lives saved. I realized that the past failures had strengthened me, taught me that no one is immune to mistakes. True leaders must learn from their failures, use the lessons to motivate themselves, and not be afraid to try again or make the next tough decision. You can't avoid the circus. At some point, we all make the list. Don't be afraid of the circus. Chapter 6. You Must Dare Greatly. If you want to change the world, slide down the obstacle head first. Standing at the edge of the 30-foot tower, I grabbed the thick nylon rope. One end of the rope was attached to the tower, and the other end anchored on the ground to a pole 100 feet away. I was halfway through the SEAL obstacle course, and I was on a record pace. Swinging my legs over the top of the line and holding on for dear life, I began to inch my way off the platform. My body hung underneath the rope, and with a caterpillar-like motion, I slowly made my way, foot by foot, to the other end. As I reached the end, I released my grip on the line, dropped into the soft sand, and ran to the next obstacle. The other students in my class were yelling encouragement, but I could hear the SEAL instructor calling out the minutes. I had lost a lot of time on the slide for life. My possum-style technique of negotiating the long rope was just too slow, but somehow I couldn't bring myself to slide down the rope head first. Going head first off the tower, using a method called commando style, was much faster, but also much riskier. You were less stable on the top of the rope than hanging underneath, and if you fell and injured yourself, you would be washed out of the class. I crossed the finish line with a disappointing time. As I was doubled over, trying to catch my breath, a grizzled old Vietnam vet with highly polished boots and a heavily starched green uniform stood hunched over me. "When are you going to learn, Mr. Mack?" he said with an unmistakable tone of contempt. "That obstacle course is going to beat you every time unless you start taking some risks." 1 week later, I pushed my fears aside, mounted the top of the rope, and thrust my body headfirst down the slide for life. As I crossed the finish line in a personal best, I could see the old Vietnam SEAL nodding his approval. It was a simple lesson in overcoming your anxieties and trusting your abilities to get the job done. The lesson would serve me well in the years to come. It was Iraq in 2004. The voice on the other end of the radio was calm, but had an unmistakable sense of urgency. The three hostages we were searching for had been located. Al-Qaeda terrorists were holding them in a walled compound on the outskirts of Baghdad. Unfortunately, intelligence indicated that the terrorists were about to move the men, and we had to act quickly. The Army Lieutenant Colonel, in charge of the rescue mission, informed me that they would have to conduct a dangerous daylight raid. To make matters worse, the only way to be successful was to land three Black Hawk helicopters carrying the assault force into the middle of the small compound. We talked through other tactical options, but it was clear the colonel was right. It was always preferable to conduct a rescue mission at night, when the element of surprise was on your side. But this was a fleeting opportunity, and if we didn't act now, the hostages would be moved and possibly killed. I approved the mission, and within minutes, the rescue force had boarded the three Black Hawk helicopters and was now on its way to the compound. High above the Blackhawks, another helicopter was providing video surveillance back to my headquarters. I watched in silence as the three helicopters skimmed across the desert, just a few feet above the ground to hide their approach. Inside the open courtyard, I could see one man, armed with an automatic weapon, moving in and out of the building, seemingly preparing to leave. The helos were 5 minutes out, and all I could do from my headquarters was listen to the internal communications as the rescue force made final preparations. This was not the first hostage rescue I had overseen, nor would it be the last, but it was clearly the most daring in light of the need to gain surprise by landing inside the compound. While the pilots from the Army Aviation Unit were the best in the world, this was still a high-risk mission. Three helicopters, with blades extending beyond 60 feet, were going to land in a space with only inches to spare. Adding to the level of difficulty was an 8-foot-high brick wall that surrounded the compound, forcing the pilots to dramatically alter their approach angle. It was going to be a hard landing, and over the radio, I could hear the rescue force preparing for impact. From the overhead surveillance, I could see the helicopter's final approach. The first aircraft flew flat and level, and then as it crossed over the wall, the helo flared upward, settling into the tiny courtyard. Immediately, the rescue force exited the Black Hawk and began surging into the building. The second helo, right on the tail of the first, landed within a few feet of his companion. Dirt from the downwash of the helicopters caused a cloud of dust to encircle the landing area. As the third helo approached the compound, a giant plume of dust temporarily blinded the pilot. The front of the third helo inched over the wall, but the rear wheel clipped the 8-foot-high barricade, throwing bricks everywhere. With no room to spare, the pilot forced the helo to the ground with a thud, but everyone inside was unharmed. Minutes later, I received word that all the hostages were safe. Within 30 minutes, the rescue force and the freed men were on their way back to safety. The gamble had paid off. Over the course of the next decade, I would come to realize that assuming risk was typical of our special operations forces. They always pushed the limits of themselves and their machines in order to be successful. In many ways, this is what set them apart from everyone else. However, contrary to what outsiders saw, the risk was usually calculated, thoughtful, and well-planned. Even if it was spontaneous, the operators knew their limits, but believed in themselves enough to try. Throughout my career, I always had great respect for the British Special Air Service, the famed SAS. The SAS motto was, "Who dares wins." The motto was so widely admired that even moments before the Bin Laden raid, my command sergeant major quoted it to the SEALs preparing for the mission. To me, the motto was more than about how the British Special Forces operated as a unit. It was about how each of us should approach our lives. Life is a struggle, and the potential for failure is ever present. But those who live in fear of failure, or hardship, or embarrassment, will never achieve their potential. Without pushing your limits, without occasionally sliding down the rope headfirst, without daring greatly, you will never know what is truly possible in your life.